Axel has a very interesting evolution, I think, in this. You know, he's one of the great minds in this whole thing. But he's actually investigated in detail some of these projects in India, and he's become a sort of whistleblower for what's actually happening in terms of additionality. I mean, yeah. Axel and I would disagree. I mean, Axel thinks there is such a thing as additionality. He thinks that actually the concept makes sense. I would argue that there is no such thing as additionality or not additionality, that this concept is actually scientifically meaningless. I'd like to explain that, but I'm worried about running out of time. Could we talk about this maybe afterwards? Because I want to give, instead of giving my view on additionality, I'd like to give the view of some villagers in Brazil who actually were responding directly to your question. And since, you know, I'm here, you can talk to me, but you can't talk to them. So let me put their view up first. This is a plantation project in Brazil which did not succeed, I think, in getting in producing carbon credits. But it's a miniaturized plantar carbon project, very famous one, probably some of you know about it. Eucalyptus plantation, which was pre-existing for producing charcoal, for producing pig iron, for producing cars, and other steel products. It's pre-existed the carbon market and has been contested by the local people for a long time. You can see why. It takes away their land and it replaces it with something they can't use and which is of no particular benefit to them, and which is environmentally damaging as a result. It's connected intimately with this charcoal production, which, you know, there's problems of slave labor and health and a lot of other things. So the local people have been opposed to this, you know, before the carbon market came along. It wasn't isn't the carbon market as such they're objecting to. They're objecting to Plantar, the company, and the way it's proceeded, the way it's taken away their jobs, the way it's destroyed their livelihoods. We say no to the green desert. That's what they call these eucalyptus plantations, is the green desert, because it's not something which supports them or gives them jobs or anything like that. But this company, of course, did want extra money, and the consultants came knocking at their door and said, you know, you can get some from the carbon market, we'll help you out. And the World Bank was helping out a lot. The World Bank sort of went from one justification to another to try to figure out how to get carbon money to Plantar, you know. And it all had to do with additionality, you know. It's just, you know, the argument in this case, one of the second or third argument which the World Bank used for giving carbon money to this environmentally destructive corporation was that, well, gosh, there are eucalyptus plantations there, you know, they're taking down carbon from the atmosphere, but if we don't give them the carbon money, they'll stop using eucalyptus and they'll turn to mineral coal. And, you know, one thing that we know is that using mineral coal for a fuel is going to be worse than using eucalyptus charcoal for a fuel. So to prevent them from doing that, give them carbon money. Give this company carbon money so they can keep the eucalyptus plantation standing. I mean, it's an interesting argument in itself, but just empirically, there are a few questions about that, given that there is a huge surplus of, you know, eucalyptus wood in that area of Brazil. There was no real problem about price, but they were able to fix the documents. But what I'd like to call your attention to actually is what some of the local trade unions, local groups, and academics and activists in the area said about that kind of argument. The argument that producing pig iron from charcoal is less bad than producing it from coal is a sinister strategy. What about the emissions that still happen in the pig iron industry? You know, what we really need are investments in clean energies that contribute to the cultural, social, and economic well-being of local populations. I think it's worth pausing and just sort of thinking about that for a second, because it goes to the heart of the scientific dispute about additionality. What these people are saying is that they feel very uncomfortable with the idea of an outside, third-party consultant, highly scientifically trained, coming in and saying, okay, well, if you don't have the carbon money for keeping, you know, the eucalyptus plantation standing, then there's only one possible alternative, which is that they'll turn to coal. The local people feel very uncomfortable with this sort of argument. They say, who is it that's deciding what our future would be? Who is it that's deciding that we only have one future without this carbon money? Someone's coming in and telling us what our future is. Someone's coming in and telling us, you know, we don't need to think about actually getting rid of plant power, about investments in clean energies. We don't think about all these other alternative futures, but only about the single alternative future that the carbon money does not come in for the eucalyptus plantations. And that's a very scientific point. Because what the carbon market tells you is that you need a single number. You need a single number of credits that you're producing. You need to be able to compare, you know, what business as usual would have been with what happens when you get the carbon money to keep your eucalyptus plantation standing. If you have many different numbers, if you have many different possibilities, if they don't get the carbon money, it's useless for the market because you need one number to generate your number of credits. I would argue what we have here is a case of the economic tail wagging the scientific dog. What's happened is that the requirements of the market, which are written into law in the Kyoto Protocol, has actually come to determine the nature of these institutions, what the work of these consultants, in such a way that they are more or less forced to do unscientific work. They are more or less forced to think unscientifically in order to provide the numbers. Now, I'm not even talking about conflict of interest and the fact that, you know, the consultants are looking for more jobs after they finish this job and they have to find some way of justifying the carbon credits. You can leave that political point, you can actually leave aside. I'm just talking about the science. So, I mean, I think that's what the local people are saying is actually very profound in terms of the way science has become linked to this market politics in the offset market. I don't think it would be more scientifically acceptable because, as I say, I don't think there's any such thing as additionality or non-additionality, but I think it would be certainly more socially acceptable, and, I mean, if you wanted to go through that process, of course, but I think also that the question is really entirely hypothetical because it's not going to happen. This would create, you know, enormous transaction costs, you know, enormous trouble, you know, enormous controversy. This is not what the buyers of carbon credits want. It's not what the UN wants in trying to get the Kyoto Protocol working. I mean, it would just lead to more trouble and more delays. That's the way it's structured.
How about no cap for the project in Bolivia? I mean, it would meet all the criteria that you've outlined.
No, Kemp is an interesting case. I mean, I think it also is controversial, but I certainly don't, I mean, to get to your general point, I certainly don't deny that there are projects, offset projects, which are locally friendly. There are offset projects which actually are doing good, which are welcomed by the local people. Noel Kemp, I think, is a little controversial, but take a better example would be Kayasa in South Africa. This is welcomed by local people. It really is clean energy. You know, it's a good project locally from your development perspective. The only problem is the carbon market doesn't support it. It's supported by subsidies from the state. Because it's very troublesome. I mean, it's like, I think in the pilot version of that project, there were like 10, one of the reasons it worked was there were only 10 households or something involved in it. So everybody was, you know, jumping up and down and saying, yeah, at last, you know, a responsible, local-friendly project. You know, let's all pile in there and do this sort of project. Well, as I said, I mean, the market is actually supported by other things, not the car. In market terms, it's not viable. The other interesting thing is that, well, it's actually, you know, because it's such a good project, it's quite difficult to scale it up, and you find all these people, you know, like the G8 notoriously, tried to buy carbon credits from, you know, the future expansion of this wonderful project to offset their G8 meeting in Scotland, and the scandal came out. The scandal came out in yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So so it's the jet flights for the ministers and everything. But the problem was that, and this came out in the newspapers, was that, you know, they were claiming that, you know, this offset came from this wonderful local project. But it actually hadn't been scaled up yet, and it wasn't, whether it would even be able to be scaled up to the scale required was very doubtful. So it was a bit of a scandal because the entire G8 meeting was being offset by these 10 shacks in a township in South Africa. So it was a bit of a scandal. But yeah.
Well, I just
this empire, and then sustainability starts becoming how do we make this empire sustainable?
how do we continue this way of living, this colonial empire-based, technological-based society of extraction and shipping all around the world, modernly seen as globalization and other kinds of things, how do we keep that sustainable? And I think if we approach it in that way, we're already asking the wrong question. It's not so much about looking for the answers, it's about figuring out what the right questions are and then taking the time to realize how those questions have complete life-changing effects on our lives. And how, not how are we going to like change our existing lifestyle enough to fix it, but how can we start over? How can we look back? Where have we gone wrong? It's not just industrial revolution. It goes farther back. It goes farther back. And how can we learn from people who have been violently oppressed throughout this entire history and are continuing to be violently oppressed within this so-called solution that people who've done this in the first place are coming up with to get themselves out of this thing? But they're like, oh shit, now it's going to hurt us too. What do we do?
I would only add to that, to try to connect that to the crisis, to the climate crisis as well. I mean, one of the things that, you know, both of your remarks call attention to is that, you know, this is actually connected to answers to the climate crisis. I mean, the answers that, you know, the local people in the plantation areas you talk about, or I don't know, maybe in Colombia as well. I mean, the answers that the local people already have to the climate crisis, including low carbon ways of life, which are continually developing. We're not talking about traditional societies here. We're talking about modern societies, which are developing based on old, you know, older low carbon ways of living. These are actually being actively undermined and, in some cases, destroyed by a system of offsets, particular offsets, which are meant to provide alternatives and answers to the climate crisis. They're destroying some of the, you know, some of the raw materials, some of the sort of developed solutions that actually already exist at the grassroots in terms of sustainable agriculture. You know, I have another example here of low carbon irrigation being destroyed by small hydro, getting CDM credits and so forth. You know, the climate aspect of this is often invisible because we don't think of these, you know, technological, you know, societies, we don't think of these as climate solutions. But, you know, as somebody once said of, you know, when you take apart an engine and, you know, put it back together, you know, the first rule is to save the parts, you know, save the things that you have, save the things that work so that you can continue to build on them. And a lot of the things that work in terms of dealing with climate change, which we already have, which we already know about, or which if we don't know about, other people know about them, are actually being actively destroyed by carbon offsets, by some of these projects. It looks like we're really running out of time, and I promised Julian to give some time to him at the end. I don't know how. Do you want? I'm happy if people who want to discuss things further stay after, and happy to continue the discussion. But I think maybe some time should be given to Julian to sort of connect this with maybe more local things just at the end of the official session here.
I'll be really, really brief with this, but I think I'm going to be around here for a while, and Larry's just visiting this Monday, so I think it's mostly about what he has to say. I'm part of a group called Rising Tide, and we're an international network of autonomous decentralized organizations working, trying to find community-based responses to the climate change crisis. A lot of kind of like the guiding frameworks of this is working on centering indigenous sovereignty in this, and figuring out how to work consolidating, especially approaching the climate crisis from the perspective of most fossil fuels need to remain in the ground. What are the environmental justice campaigns that are working in areas of extraction or burning to stop those things from existing, whether it's Navajo people fighting coal mining, or white Appalachians fighting coal mining, or people all over the world who are fighting the fossil fuel production thing on a certain level, and supporting people in their struggle through all the different means that people use to stop these things from coming out of the ground in the first place. So sometimes it's lobbying, sometimes it's direct action going and shutting down the power plants. There's a whole range of ways in which communities are engaged in these long-term kind of struggles and trying to figure out how to pull resources to support these kind of struggles. And then also come up with things like the house that I live at in Providence is an urban homestead. We have all the kind of stuff with like gray water systems and thermal solar panels installed and composting everything. Trying to do that, having to be in an education center or something like that too. So we do a pretty wide range of stuff. I'm going to stop there, but there's a sign-up sheet if you're interested more in Rising Tide and what we're doing. Keep that sign-up sheet passed around. I can set up some kind of other Rising Tide information session. I'm also going to pass around this video. This is a documentary. One of the things we do is set up these things called climate camps, and they're a space for grassroots groups from a whole spectrum to come together for a week to 10 days of both embodying sustainable living in terms of how the campus is set up and how it's structured and where the food comes from and where the energy comes from, everything like that, directly sustainable in terms of homemade wind turbines and that kind of stuff. Having tons of workshops on a whole range of stuff, all about hands-on skills, how to do these things, information about all of these different complicated issues, and then also a day of direct action where a target is picked, that is a local target that embodies the threat that we're facing and saying that we can't wait around for these kind of regulatory things to stop. We as citizens need to get together and say these are the things that, not about modifying them, it's about shutting them down and then figuring out how do we work with each other in order to live the way we want to be living. And so it's kind of a different way of approaching the whole debate. And this is a documentary about the camp that happened in England a couple years ago. It was against Drax coal-fired power plants. This last year they had a target against Heathrow Airport extension. I'm talking about how the entire, just the emissions from Heathrow Airport expanding would equal the entire amount that the UK is supposed to be decreasing their emissions under the Heathrow protocol. And the hypocrisy in that. So I'll pass it around. I've got a bunch of copies to sell. If you're interested, come talk to me, or we can also set up a screening. We also have a False Solutions campaign where we target the carbon trading industry and go to industry conferences and try to get up on stage and give you other perspective and stuff like that. So come talk to me more. I'll be around. You can email me at jdrips@brown.edu.
Also, if anybody wasn't able to get their free copy of this book because we might not have enough, you can come to me and give me your name, and I can get the Swedish publishers to send you a free copy if you're interested.
That's it.